This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Great to have you with us on the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. This is your chance to catch up on some of the best bits, connect with experts around the region and hear real life stories too. You might not know, but April is Limb Loss Awareness Month. In conversation with Jessica Smith, she's an activist, a former Paralympian who swam for her native Australia. She lives here in Dubai with her three kids and is on hand to offer a bit of an inside track, really, on what it's like to live with disability, how we should be talking about living with differences and educating our kids too, plus the significance of this awareness month. And again, with a focus on health, blood donations are needed right now more than ever. With Ramadan upon us, it is, of course, a really important time to make sure our blood banks are full, and of COVID, of course, adding further complications. In conversation with Dr. George from Genesis Clinic, he's a specialist in high-risk pregnancies and births, obstetrics and gynaecology. He was talking about some of the circumstances that might lead to blood transfusions in the labour ward and was on hand to take your questions too. And I love talking education and ultimately where it can lead people. Yusuf is just 18. He's got two businesses and a raft of scholarships at his disposal. Talking about the 64,000 applications, he was one of just 20 people to receive one scholarship that will be taking him to Boston University. But how did he do it? And, well, I've got to be honest, when it comes to YouTube Kids, I've got a bit of a love-hate relationship. Yes, it's incredibly useful. It's a great source of entertainment slash distraction for my children. But there are some particular bits of content and even particular content creators that I just cannot stand. In conversation with Dalia Alfeki from the MENA region's Google and YouTube office, talking about some of the hidden features you might not know about, some of the new bits of that platform that can help us as parents to control safely and limit screen time and, yes, even block certain channels. And if you've been feeling a bit lonely during the pandemic, maybe you're a new mum or recently moved to Dubai, or is unfortunate enough to have lost some friends to heading back to their own home countries, maybe it's time to freshen up your friendship group. Mama Ami is an app that launched last year, the height of the pandemic, helping connect parents right here in the UAE. So should you swipe for some new mum mates? We were finding out more.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Marking today Limb Loss Awareness Month, in conversation with Jessica Smith, an amazing former Paralympian and activist, born without part of her left arm. And she says disability, disabled, are often seen as negative, a burden, and highly stigmatised. They need to be redefined if we're to see some real changes on how society deals with dealing with inclusion.
Yeah, I think having Limb Loss Awareness Week, gives us an opportunity to know who else is in our community, whether that's local or, you know, far and beyond, and gives us a sense of, you know, feeling connected and feeling as though we belong. Certainly when I was growing up, I didn't know any other people who were missing their limb, you know, arms or legs. And so I felt very isolated and even disconnected from my own family in many ways, because I had a lot of questions that they weren't able to answer, you know. And so a month like this gives us an opportunity to come together, and also really important for families. Because, you know, my parents had a lot of questions that they wanted to ask, you know, from their perspective as well. And I can appreciate that now as a parent myself, you know, wanting to understand or to help teach me how to do things in a different way, or to understand, you know, when to let me do things by myself, you know, and not sort of intervene, you know, and what that looks like. And I suppose raising awareness gives families the opportunity to be able to learn from one another. And, you know, I didn't have that growing up. So now as an adult, you know, I appreciate what my parents went through, and in the space that I have now and the platform that I have now as an activist around disability awareness, you know, I think this is a really important time to be able to bring people together. But also the fact that we still don't know how many people are being born with limb differences, and how many children perhaps are being born with other disabilities that then they need to go on and have amputations very early on in those first few months or first few years of life. And so this month around the world, also is bringing awareness to the medical profession as well. And we're trying to create registers so that we can understand how many people, you know, are living a life, you know, with a limb difference. And the reason that's important is because once you have those statistics, then it can also lead into the medical profession to find answers. So for me, I don't know why I was born missing my left arm. And a lot of people, you know, my age in particular, we don't have the answers. And I think, again, now as a parent, I appreciate how agonizing that would be. You know, you want to know why, you want to understand, you know, what went wrong? Did I do anything wrong? You know, was it an environmental, you know, impact? What was it? And I think that, you know, if we can start to find those answers, it gives a lot more reassurance to those people living with a disability and their families.
I think that's so, so important. And when we think about what's changed in the last few decades in terms of technology, and I'm not just talking about medical advancements, I'm certainly talking about social media, which is, you know, demonized in oh so many ways. But, you know, the way you're using your platform in terms of raising awareness as an activist, that is so valuable to so many people. So can you take us back to the beginning, Jessica? You mentioned you were born with part of your left arm missing. So is this something that happened then in the womb? You were born that way? And then did your parents know before you were born that, that was going to be the case?
No, so unfortunately they didn't know. And I think that was just a result of technology back in the days. I mean, I'm mid-30s now, and you know, there weren't as many scans, and I think maybe there were some shadows that were in particular places that made the doctors believe that, you know, my left arm was sort of just hiding, or you couldn't see it. And so my parents didn't know until the day I was born, and then, you know, obviously the panic and the unknowing that filled the room in that moment. I think, you know, that would have been very scary for first time parents. Also the doctors sort of thinking, well, what's happened here? What's gone wrong? You know, and then not really knowing how to then find the answer. In the last couple of years, or probably in the last decade, there's been a lot more research done that suggests that amniotic bands are formed in the womb, and they can often wrap around limbs and then stop them from growing. And that is the explanation that I think I've sort of accepted as my reality. The other explanation is that perhaps it's blood clots in very early development in the womb. But again, there's no definitive answer for me. And even for children that are born today, I think that those two explanations are what, you know, are provided by the medical professionals. That is also hard to sort of comprehend because it's something that's not spoken about. And, you know, ironically, a friend of mine back in Australia recently gave birth to a daughter the same day as I had my third son. Actually, they're about 16 months now, and she was born missing her right arm. And, you know, she just wanted to understand why. And I think for me then as a friend, you know, for this first time mother, you know, we're similar ages, to see it from a different perspective, to see it from the parent perspective. And I think growing up, you know, there was a lot of angst sometimes between myself and my parents because I had questions that they couldn't answer. And I think there was a lot of frustration for both of us, you know, wanting to understand what was going on. And certainly there were times when my parents felt, you know, we don't know, you know, and we feel guilty and we feel like we're to blame, but we're not. And me also learning through, you know, growing up in my teens and my 20s, that it's nobody's fault. Sometimes these things just do happen. But it can be very hard to live with that. And certainly for me growing up, you know, throughout my teens, wanting some answers and wanting to understand why I was different, you know, what had I done to deserve this reality? And so I did struggle a lot with body image issues growing up. But now, you know, I look back and I realize that, you know, my disability in many ways has been my superpower. And that's what the message that I want to get out there. And you touched on the importance of social media before. Social media is fantastic for raising awareness about disability and other minority groups, because for so many of us, we would never have had a platform prior to, social media. The simple nature around disability and limb loss and difference. And so being able to have the platform that I do to be able to speak up, I know I have a responsibility to share my story, because when we share our lived experiences, we help the collective heal. And that's what's so important. So I think that, you know, being born in the 80s and now, you know, experiencing the profound impact that social media can have on raising awareness for minority groups of all sorts.
The world has a lot of catching up to do when it comes to representation of different groups. And if, you know, if you feel like you have an opportunity to represent yourself and people you know, and you do have this platform, then, you know, more power to you, because we need to be showing brands, organizations, governments even, that there are people of all different ages, abilities, nationalities, you know, cultural backgrounds, and everyone deserves to have a, you know, a seat at the table in so many ways. So I'm sure your friend's situation is going to be completely different to what your parents went through in the 80s. Yeah. And you know, you mentioned the kind of the shock and the worry in the delivery room. What was their reaction then, and what was their attitude around you in the world and in the classroom and, you know, on the sports field and things growing up? And what impact do you think that's had on your attitude?
I'm very grateful for the fact that my parents were able to see past a lot of what the medical professionals were saying, because they had this idea that disability in any sense of the word was a burden and a tragedy, you know, and they would say to my parents, you know, that you're going to have struggles and things will be difficult. And I'm sure my parents, you know, took that on board as well. But I'm just grateful that they allowed me the opportunity to explore and navigate my own world. Mm-hmm. And they gave me the space to learn how to do things in my own way. So simple things like tying my shoelaces or tying my hair, you know, a lot of things that people take for granted, daily tasks that I had to learn how to do that. Again, I didn't have social media. I didn't have YouTube to look at videos. You know, my mum and dad would try and show me, but I'm like, you can't show me because you don't have one arm. And so I have to find my own way to do this. And thankfully they were like, okay, we give you this space and we respect, you know, that this is what you want to do. I grew up with three younger brothers. We're a very sporty family. And I think sport gave me a sense of freedom as well. It was the first time that I was able to use my body and to show myself and everyone around me what my body could do rather than what it couldn't. And I think, you know, in the work that I do now is trying to shift societal's ideas and expectations of what disability is and what it isn't. And, you know, for me, I have had so many amazing opportunities in my life because I was born missing my left arm. And that's what I want people to understand, is that my life is not a burden. It's not a tragedy. There's so many amazing things that I've been able to do, but it's because of the fact that I have a disability.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Great to have you with us on this Sunday afternoon. We are marking Limb Loss Awareness Month in conversation with Jessica Smith, who's based right here in Dubai, but who swam for her country in the Paralympics. She was born with most of her left arm missing, but is physically stronger than probably, frankly, you or I. She's talking about the importance of redefining some of the terms and how society deals with members born with differences.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
There's nothing wrong with those words if they're used in the context that's respectful and that is from a space of wanting to learn and understand. And so I want to be able to answer people's questions, especially children. You know, they're so inquisitive and they just want to understand their world. And so for me, you know, especially if I'm in the park with my kids and, you know, I hear someone say, oh, mummy, that lady has one arm. Often I will hear parents then say, shh, don't, you know, shh. And I'll say, no, it's okay. You know, I do have one arm. And that's another part of what I share, especially for adults and parents, is that you are the role models for your children. And so when you say, shh, or let's not talk about it, you're sending a very clear message that disability is wrong or it's different, it's negative, it's something that we shouldn't talk about. And that's not the message that we want to portray at all. We want our children to be able to feel comfortable saying, I see difference, I see something that I haven't seen before, and then to acknowledge that, and then it's okay. You know, to let all the stigma and the illusion to just fade away. And so I think parents often are anxious about, you know, disrespecting people and not sure how to have that conversation. And I totally understand that. But I think what parents also need to understand, it's okay if you don't have the answers as well. So if your child says, you know, why does that lady have one arm? It's totally okay to say, you know what, I'm not sure. Maybe we could go and ask her. And I think, you know, obviously because I have three children as well, you know, it makes that conversation a lot easier. And I want to encourage that. You know, I want children to be able to feel confident and comfortable to identify difference and then be able to go on with their day. And so often, I also say to parents, don't then have another conversation at home behind closed doors saying, oh, remember that lady that we saw with one arm? You know, we're not sure what happened to her. Don't make it a huge issue, because often when we put so much emphasis on it in behind closed doors, kids are like, well, why? Why can't we talk about it normally? Why can't we have these conversations? Why do we have to and that's the wrong messaging. And so I think, we don't often see disability a lot here in Dubai, but if you do see me in the park or at the mall, please, and if your children want to ask questions and that, they see that I look different, I only have one arm, allow them to explore that curiosity. I think it's really important, because that's a generation now, if we allow them to do that, that are going to grow up with, no matter what differences are, to feel as though they can have those conversations.
That really resonates with me. It really, really does, because my children ask endless questions about everything. And as parents, we don't always have the answers. And I think that's really valuable to know that we could come to you and say, my daughter has a few questions. Would it be okay? We don't, a lot of it comes out of fear of, not wanting to use the so-called wrong terminology or say the wrong thing or upset or offend anybody. Stigma and shame kind of thrive in these environments of silence, and it just needs to be more open. But we as parents have a bit of work to do as well. Yeah. So much of the opportunities have come to you because of the attitude that your parents had towards ambition and sport and enjoyment and fulfillment and integration, and that's obviously been passed on to you and your enjoyment of sports. Took you to the Paralympics and swimming, which is just incredible. And what about now? How do you like to stay active, and what kind of relationship do you have with your body now?
Yeah, I think, that relationship with sport and representing my country at the Paralympics gave me, like I said, a sense of pride and exhilaration, because I was able to use my body. I was able to feel strong and powerful and free and not limited by what society told me my body could or couldn't do. Mm-hmm. And that is such an amazing feeling. And so even today, I am very active. I get down to F45 as much as I can. I'm out at the beach with the kids. I'm out at the park with the kids, trying to just use my body and to be grateful for what I'm able to do, and to show people that as well, and to show my children that, that just because I live with a disability, it doesn't have to stop me from doing things. And I think that I'm trying to be the best role model as I can for my children in that regard as well, for them to see that, it doesn't matter what you look like. It's about the attitude, and it's about how you embrace challenges or obstacles in your life, and how you apply yourself to overcoming those things that is what's really important.
Family Matters
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is on Monday, see, you can tell I've been on holiday. It's Sunday that we talk about children's health, about parenting, about education, and delighted to be in conversation with mum of three, Jessica Smith. She's from Australia, swam for her country in the Paralympics, and lives here in Dubai. She's an activist raising awareness around living with differences. She was born with part of her left arm missing, had an accident, and is now on a mission to be a role model and to educate as well. It is Limb Loss Awareness Month, and she's got some advice for parents whose kids are living with differences.
Technology is advancing rapidly, and there are amazing prosthetics that have been created. I mean, you can do 3D printing of arms. There's a physician in Australia that is doing that for some of the young kids, and it's just phenomenal to think, how far we've come. The prosthetics that I had when I was a child resembled more like a claw, and it wrapped all around my body, and it was hideous. And it was actually really hard to train my brain into thinking that I did have an arm. I think a lot of people took that for granted. It's like, oh, this will just be normal and help you. And I was like, well, actually, no, it's really difficult. The opportunity to have social media and to have little videos and tutorials that allow people to see somebody like them, firstly represented, but two, doing things, daily tasks that they can't see anybody else like them do, and I think that would have been really beneficial for me growing up, and the fact that is available now. There are lots of people out there living with a limb difference who are saying, this is how I do things. And I think that makes a huge difference. Ironically, though, I don't need technology. And I think this is another conversation that's also important to have, is that we don't necessarily need to fix disability. Disability doesn't mean that somebody's broken, and I did wear a prosthetic up until the age of 8. It caused a lot of issues actually for me. I sustained a horrific burns scalding accident in the kitchen when I was 18 months old, because I reached up with my amazing new arm, but I didn't feel the kettle and I knocked it down onto myself. So I have burns and scars on 15% of my body. I continued to wear the prosthetic for about 8 years, but it was just more difficult, you know, for me. Everything, you know, I would drop things, I would hit things. I would sometimes use it if I was fighting with my younger brothers. So I think my parents were like, okay, we need to just, this is not what it was meant for. Yeah. And so I think this is where it's important about awareness and around the conversation, because not everything can be fixed with technology, especially when it comes to disability. And I appreciate that there are a lot of amazing, very smart people working in this field to try and make life easier. And for that, you know, I'm grateful. But I think that it really depends on the individual. And that's why we have to have these conversations, because one, you know, advantage in the technical space doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a positive aid for everybody living with a disability. And I think that that's really important, you know, and the statistics around people living with a disability. I've read somewhere that there's at least 93 million children living with a disability at the moment. And again, we don't know for sure. I suspect that it's much higher because of the shame and the stigma that's associated with that, especially, you know, in many third world countries where they don't want to, you know, share that information. And so I think it really depends on where you are and sort of what your disability might be. For me, I don't need those aids in my life at the moment, but that's not to say that other people don't really benefit from them. And I think the fact that there's so much happening in that space is very exciting. And also, you know, this idea that robotic prosthetics are actually seen as quite cool now. And again, that has been helped through social media to say, you know what, these things like Robocop and these movies that were around, you know, so many years ago are coming to life for people with a disability. It was also really funny. I was with two friends of mine, one girl who was a double leg amputee, and we were at an event. This was a couple of years ago. She was quite tall and we were like, what's going on? And she's like, oh, well, I got these, my legs sort of lengthened. And my other friend who doesn't have a disability was like, well, that's completely unfair. And it's like, well, is it?
Wouldn't you choose really if you could?
Yeah, exactly. A fascinating conversation, you know, when you think, wow, is disability really a disadvantage, you know? And I think the more we can have these conversations where people feel relaxed about it, you know, and can laugh in the right context and to say, wow, you know, there are so many wonderful things that people with a disability can do and are doing. And let's talk about that rather than, you know, hush it to the side and hide it away, because, you know, that does nothing. And then that pushes us further back. And I think that we're doing so much in the space of technology that it will be really, really interesting to see what happens in the next few years.
And lastly, Jessica, I just wanted to ask you if there's any parents out there who may have had a scan that showed up any differences, or there's a genetic issue, or perhaps their baby has been born with limb loss or a condition that may need amputation in the future. What advice would you give to a parent, you know, as you did with your friend when her little one was born?
Absolutely recommend that you reach out to people who are in the same situation. So, you know, there are organisations. I'm not actually familiar with awareness organisations here in the UAE, but there are plenty in the UK, in Australia and in America, and you can find them all through social media. You can contact me personally and I can, you know, I'd be more than happy to put you in touch with the right people. But I think that that's where this awareness month and the groups and the communities that exist are so helpful, because it just makes sure that you don't feel alone, that you don't feel disconnected, and that there's a sense of hope there, because that's the other important thing. I as a parent, again, I can appreciate just how scary, you know, that could be. And you know, limb loss and limb difference is much more identifiable in those, you know, early scans now. Parents are aware, you know, and it's a very personal journey, a very personal decision as to, you know, what then happens. But I think it's not something to be scared of. It's not something to be afraid of. There's so many wonderful things. There's so many wonderful people living with, you know, limb difference and all sorts of other disabilities. And I think that we need to start allowing our realm of understanding society to open up to that, so that when people are in a situation where they feel like they don't know where to go, they don't know where to turn, that it becomes a lot more easier. They say, okay, we can help you, we can offer support, we can give you resources, we can put you in the right direction in terms of, you know, medical support and things like that. So for anyone out there who might have any questions, please feel free to contact me. I would be more than happy to answer any questions.
As you said, there's a huge amount of information on your Instagram, both about your personal journey, but also information, tutorials. What's the best way of finding you online, Jessica?
Yes, please visit me on Instagram, jessicasmith27. Also my website, which is jessicasmith.com.au. I have the links to all the videos as well. And yeah, it's just wonderful to connect. And I hope that through sharing my journey, I can offer, you know, everyone in society an insight into what living with a disability is like, and that it's a wonderful, wonderful journey. And I wouldn't change it at all. I would never go back and change anything, because I'm the person I am today because of the fact that I have a disability. We are
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is Limb Loss Awareness Month, and joined now by Mandeep Giselle, behavioural therapist at Priory Wellbeing Centre here in Dubai. Mandeep, we heard earlier from Jessica, who I think spoke so, so well about her kind of lived experience as someone who was born missing a limb, but also about her, you know, being in the world now and how much things have changed for the positive, not just on the technology side, but medically speaking, and how hopefully we're moving to a place where there is less stigma. I'd love to get from your point of view in terms of clients that you see coming in or families that come to you with concerns, you know, children living with physical disabilities. What kind of issues can manifest, and are you the person to come to if that is the case?
Absolutely. I mean, at the Priory Wellbeing Centre, we have kind of a range of professionals, from counsellors to psychiatrists and the therapists who are trained in all different modalities. So some of the issues, for example, that can manifest are anxiety disorders, low self-esteem, bullying is very common. So yeah, these are the kind of issues that we would deal with. They are kind of mental health issues, emotional problems that clients present with.
I think what Jessica's kind of, my big takeaway from her is that, you know, we need to be talking more. You know, inclusion is only going to lead to greater understanding, you know, the community coming together, you know, freedom to ask questions. But so many kids perhaps haven't been raised in an environment where, you know, asking questions or transparency about differences is commonplace, which, as you said, can lead to bullying. Some kids simply don't know how to behave around people who have some kind of physical or even, you know, psychological difference.
Yeah, I think, I mean, part of it is that it's all of our responsibility as adults, parents, school teachers, kind of everybody's responsibility to kind of educate children to be kind. I mean, it sounds like a really simple message, but to be kind. And children learn best through guidance rather than sort of enforcing rules. Children, more than anybody, are kind of so creative, and especially at the age of 4 and 5, that's when they are kind of most sensitive to issues, and, you know, have really high levels of empathy and extreme kind of understanding on concepts like this. I think it's kind of everybody's responsibility, and I can relate to one of Jessica's posts. She talks about, you know, how her environment growing up was completely normalised in her kind of family home. And I mean, I actually was born with a disfigurement on my right hand as well. So I absolutely can understand, you know, what it feels like growing up. And but growing up in a home with a family who just totally treated me sort of no differently to my siblings. And, you know, I would have been given a pen in my left hand or my right hand, or whichever hand I wrote with. But I think it's kind of everybody's responsibility to teach children to be kind, to be curious. It's okay to ask questions, but to guide them rather than kind of forcing them to learn a certain way. Specifically, kind of at the ages of 4 and 5 is when children are kind of extremely accepting at this age of issues. And so part of it is also kind of how we talk with our children about these issues, how parents and teachers talk to their children about these issues, the kind of messages that they're sending as well. It can be important, you know, for parents or for teachers to kind of examine their own feelings, because sometimes their own feelings on certain issues, children can often sort of pick up on this. Yeah, children are very sensitive to kind of their parents' emotions. So if you sense that, you know, you may be uncomfortable with diagnosis or certain disorders and problems, probably the kids will also pick up on that. And so yeah, it's more creating awareness. The more we understand about issues that, you know, that everybody has kind of differences, whether we're tall or short or big or small or have kind of deformities in any of these things, I think talking more about it helps us to all create awareness and to be kind of sensitized to issues around us. Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be a right, children, come to the table. We're going to talk about how people are different. You know, we're really lucky that obviously social media, which Jessica was speaking of, but, you know, that there are books including people of all different, you know, backgrounds and abilities. There's TV
so
programs that can be just really useful jumping off points. Is there anything that you'd like to recommend in particular?
I mean, in terms of sharing these things with kids, they absolutely love to hear things as a story rather than sharing things kind of on the spot with what an issue could be or is not. Their minds are so creative at a young age, and usually hearing something as a story that has kind of a start, middle and end really can help them to see something from the beginning to the end rather than it just being kind of a snapshot which kind of confuses them or they're not so sure about something. So, you know, we may explain that Mandy had a fever or she felt ill and then she kind of had this problem developed and she was able to go on to do, you know, many things that she feels proud of and that she enjoys, so that there is some kind of a story behind it. But I think there's so many messages now on social media that are so positive and so many people kind of opening up and talking about so many things, which allows people to just be themselves and not just their kind of illness with any kind of mental health problems and even physical problems, whether we have diabetes, cholesterol, you know, our illness is not our diagnosis. There's so much more to a human being than one kind of problem.
Well said, Mandeep Chisal there, behavioural therapist at Priory Wellbeing Centre here in Dubai. It is Limb Loss Awareness Month, not only for individuals who've had to deal with any differences, but for the rest of us too, to become more aware, sensitive to it as well, and educate our children. We are
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking health this afternoon and we see it on the news, hear about it even from our own circle of friends on social media. Blood donation has never been more important during this time. To tell us more and discuss why some high-risk pregnancies and births can lead to needing blood transfusions, delighted to be joined by Dr. George, consultant in obstetrics and gynaecology, maternal and fetal medicine at Genesis Clinic. Dr. George, how are you?
Hi, Helen. Very good afternoon. Very well. Thank you.
I feel very honoured to have stolen you away from clinic for half an hour because you're one of the busiest doctors in Dubai. You have an amazing reputation for being the go-to man for high-risk pregnancies and births. So I know half an hour is, let's just say I'm going to be picking your brains and you are taking some questions this afternoon as well. Can you tell us a little bit about your reputation and your specialty of interest when it comes to high-risk?
Yes, Helen. Maternal and fetal medicine is a part of obstetrics. It's a small part of obstetrics that deals specifically with babies and mothers that have problems during the pregnancy. So basically, it's an extra 3 years in the training in the UK that you do a lot of ultrasound. You have lots and lots of experience as the system in the UK within the NHS. It's a pyramid system, so everybody kind of ends up in a fetal medicine center when they do have problems with a pregnancy. That gives a lot of background experience. So we look after mothers that the babies experience problems with growth. We look after mothers who have multiple pregnancies and they need regular scans. We look after our diabetic moms. What is very common here in Dubai, and you can put it in inverted commas as high risk, are older mothers. And basically being able to offer that at Genesis, we do give a holistic approach to pregnancy and preparation for motherhood.
We are taking questions this afternoon as well. I'm glad you said older mothers and not geriatric mothers, because nothing cuts deeper. I can tell you, as an older mother myself, no one likes seeing that on their forms, Dr. George. Coming back to the blood donation, last year Genesis did a campaign around Give Blood, Save Lives. And we know that during Ramadan, blood banks suffer to have enough stores. And of course, with COVID, even more so. Why did you feel like that was such an important campaign to get behind?
You actually were spot on in what is happening at this particular time of the year. In general, Ramadan, always the blood banks run dry because people are fasting and you don't have so many people going for blood donation. Put that together with what happened with COVID, that the flow to the hospitals has been much less and the need for blood increased dramatically. This made it essential for people to actually go and give blood. Now, unfortunately, in obstetrics, every now and then we have mothers who bleed a lot or who are at risk of bleeding a lot. And last year we had one of our lovely mums with twins and a condition called placenta previa that we were looking for blood and getting all her relatives to go and donate for her. And this was a time that we said, actually, we need to do something as a unit and kind of get the crowd that follow us to realize how important it is to give blood and save lives.
And who is eligible is my first question. And how much can someone donate in one sitting, I guess, is perhaps the phrase. How much do you take?
So pretty much everybody can give blood. Now, obviously, there are age restrictions, so from 18 to 65 years old, not pregnant or breastfeeding mothers, and in general, good health. I think it would be good to bring COVID into play, so you cannot donate if you either had COVID within the last month or 28 days, if you obviously had a positive COVID swab test, or you are in the period of quarantine. Now, if you had your vaccine recently, as long as 7 days have passed from the date of either the first or second dose, you're absolutely fine to give blood. Now, the blood donation center, obviously, its priority is to make sure that the people who are giving blood are well. So they do a very basic health check. They will measure your blood pressure. And if your blood pressure is either very high or very low, or even during the questionnaire, you have medical conditions that may put you in a small risk by giving blood, then they will tell you either to come at a different time or that you're not okay to give blood. The whole process is really, really fast, about 10 minutes or so, the actual blood-giving process. And it's kind of painless, and actually it's a fun part. And for, I would say, certainly the men in the group, it's good to give blood at regular intervals. Women, you lose blood with your period, so it's not such a major issue. But for us, to give blood at regular intervals is actually very, very good.
Keeps it fresh. So no name on this message, Dr. George, saying 2 years ago, I had my first child, little boy. He's awesome. I had a straightforward pregnancy and was active throughout. However, birth was a totally different story. Due to reduced fetal movement, he was induced. I won't go into too much detail, but fetal distress, episiotomy, enormous blood loss, horrific delivery, and some pretty bad birth injuries for me to this day. I'm 32 and would love a second child, but I'm terrified. Does Dr. George have any advice? Well, first of all, I just want to say I'm so sorry that you went through that. I really, really am. It sounds like, you know, emotional and physical difficulties to this day. Dr. George, I think this is actually more common than we realise, a traumatic or scary birth experience leading to reluctance and fear around having another child. How can you offer some assurances to this listener?
This is so true, meaning many times we idealise how labour should be and then reality is completely different and very cruel. And a lot of women come out of the labour experience traumatised, basically having severe post-traumatic stress disorder. Two main things. One, good debriefing, either with the clinician who has been and look her after, or with a neutral clinician who can go through things. Many times it doesn't change what happened, but when you move away from the incidents, reviewing things and understanding why everything happened may help them to put things at place and just move on. Some women may need to see a psychologist or even a psychiatrist to help them give the tools to kind of gather themselves together thinking about the next pregnancy. So that would be the first step, dealing with the trauma and basically setting the foundation to move ahead. Now, in the next pregnancy, unfortunately, these ghosts, they're always going to be there, and they have a tendency to wake up as you approach delivery. So finding a team that she feels comfortable with, a clinician that is happy to sit down and talk and set up a plan for her, not what other people think that it is a good birth, but what is good for this particular mom to help with the stress and hopefully a straightforward delivery of another baby. So it's more working in the mind rather than the physical part. Mm-hmm. But obviously, some of these deliveries do leave some physical trauma that needs to be taken in account as to how you're going to plan the next delivery.
I think that's so true about making sure you've got a team around you that you really trust, you know, to be able to open up about any fears or worries. And even if you can't stick exactly to the plan that you would love to, and that, again, is very common, that it doesn't necessarily unfold that way, to know that you've got people around you who've got your best interests at heart, and really wishing you all the very best with whatever you decide there. A message here saying, I'm having an IVF pregnancy that's considered high risk for a number of reasons. One, IVF, started as twins, but one died at 9 weeks. Underactive thyroid and group strep re-identified. Does this mean I will have a high risk birth? Would love a water birth. Thank you.
A number of different things. We like to stick the high risk sticker everywhere. I think this lovely lady has a straightforward pregnancy. IVF creates issues of getting you pregnant, but unless there are other complicating factors, IVF does not necessarily make you a high risk pregnancy. It puts you in a group that is more difficult to achieve a pregnancy, but in reality, every baby has huge value, so they're not sure, some more valuable than others. That's about the IVF part. About the issue of strep B positive, this has to do more with the birth, mm-hmm. and there is a discussion about giving antibiotics during labor and having an IV line, which those things don't go together with the water birth part. What was the other two issues that you said?
Underactive thyroid.
Again, the issue with the underactive thyroid is knowing about it. Mm-hmm. So once you know and it is dealt with, again, this is not a problem. It's something that is extremely common in mums in childbearing age. So once we know and it is well controlled, it's not making this mum high risk. So two things. Again, take a step back, relax. The pregnancy is going to go fantastically well. Unfortunately, having that little incident with one of the two embryos in the early stages creates a lot of anxieties, but in the long term, it does not affect the outcome of the pregnancy. So again, it comes down working with the team that she's consulting with, basically building up her confidence that she's healthy, she's well, she has a healthy baby going along. And then when they're looking about the actual delivery, setting the right plan for the delivery, meaning that if she is Streptococcus B positive and she will need antibiotics during labor, probably the pool is not the better place for her to be, because she would have a line and an IV line running through.
Just to make sure that medicine gets to baby. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. George. Really, really appreciate your insights and advice. Would love to have you back. We've had many questions in this afternoon we haven't had time to address. So if we can squeeze another time out of your diary, I would really, really appreciate it. Thank you again and have a wonderful afternoon. It's Dr. George, who can be found at Genesis Clinic, consultant obstetric and gynaecology, maternal and fetal medicine.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Great to have you with us on this Sunday afternoon. And while I love meeting the young people, they do tend to make me feel Well, a little bit inadequate. I'm hoping Yusuf will be kind. We are so lucky here in Dubai to be home to many proud parents and some really bright young minds as well. So kudos to all the kids out there, to the parents, and of course the teachers and educators as well. Now, one teenager based right here has bagged a trustee scholarship from Boston University. He is one of just 20 out of a whopping 64,000 students who applied to receive it. Now, the trustee scholarship is a merit award that covers tuition plus orientation and mandatory fees as well. So let's get to know 18-year-old Yusuf. Yusuf, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Helen? How was your day?
Well, amazing. Massive congratulations. I mean, those numbers are just mind-blowing. 64,000 people applied for this scholarship. 20 people were successful, and you are one of them. Okay, let's go back to the beginning. How did you first hear about this scholarship?
So, actually, I heard about the scholarship towards end of November. I'm part of Hale Education. It's an education consultancy group in the UAE. And I was talking to my counselor, Peter and David, regarding if we should even be considerate of this scholarship, because the numbers say it all. Mm-hmm. So I was deciding if I should do it or not. And then we said, let's give it a shot. Let's apply for it. And we wrote the essay, and here we are today. And I go for free to university, I guess.
Honestly, the US university system is that classic double-edged sword. It's incredible, but my goodness, you've got people who are paying off a mortgage before they get a mortgage because of the debts. It's pretty staggering. It really, really is. So to be able to leapfrog all of that admin and debt, it must be a massive weight off your shoulders, and that of your parents as well. Tell us a little bit about the essay that you wrote in order to apply. What was it about?
So it's a 600-word essay, and you have two essays. You can either choose one about community service or the other one about the future and what you want to do with the future.
Mm.
So I chose the, yeah, that's pretty cool.
What did you do?
I chose the community service one.
And what did you write about?
I wrote about my initiatives in Egypt and how that helped me discover who I am today, actually.
So tell us about the initiatives. I don't want the full 600 words, but can you explain a little bit about what really makes your heart sing about what you've been doing?
So in Egypt, I attend camps every summer. And in 2019, me and some of the campers decided to start an initiative called Ikhwat, which means brotherhood and sisterhood, something around the lines of that. And instead of just giving regular food to people, we wanted to give them some sort of identity and show them that they have emotions like everyone else. So we just made basic games, basic studies. We taught them some math, some English. We played football the whole day. And that's a very simple essay, but that's what won the hearts of people at Boston, I guess.
Now, Yusuf, I don't want to make you blush, but let's let the people know this is not the only scholarship that you've bagged. What other scholarships have you been offered?
I got a $100,000 scholarship from University of Toronto.
Whoa.
120. Yeah, there's more.
Go on.
I got one from York University, one from Bentley, and the Boston Trustee Scholarship.
Oh, okay. Tell me, first of all, is your head small enough to fit through a doorway? Second of all, how proud are your parents? My goodness.
My parents are really proud. Like, that's what I tried to do it for them mainly, because I want to thank them in a way. My parents have always been supportive and telling me, we'll help you. Don't worry about the finances. Although I know it's a lot of money, they just say, don't worry. But I just wanted to help them and say thank you in a way back.
Oh, you sound amazing. Now, what are the plans? What are you going to study when you get over to the States?
I want to study entrepreneurship and innovation.
Ooh, I heard you've already got two businesses right now. What's that about?
I have a more funky and clothing line called Unwritten Lines. It's about the future and how everything's uncertain. It was inspired by COVID. And I have a health company called Sahi, which means my health in Arabic.
Yusuf, honestly, like everyone out there who's under the age, well, over the age of 20 is like, oh my goodness, this kid's going to take over the world. Did the businesses help you get a scholarship? They must demonstrate in some ways that you've got a really active interest in entrepreneurship and innovation. Did you include them in the application?
Yeah, definitely. I think the businesses and how writing the essay is what helped me stand out because, yeah, definitely. Everyone can apply for entrepreneurship, but unless you actually do something and experience what it's like to be an entrepreneur, the difficulties, the challenges, that's what sets you apart from everyone else, I guess.
So what's the plan? When you think about, you know, your dream, I'm not even say career because that's not necessarily how it works anymore, but, you know, your dream life, what kind of industries would you like to work in? What part of the world would you like to live in?
As soon as I graduate, I'd like to go back to Egypt because I still want to help some of the kids I saw there. Honestly, when you go visit Egypt in the city where I'm born, everyone there is extremely poor. And I want to start by helping those people in my town and then just expand from there.
And I wanted to ask you, you know, it's been a really, really challenging, I was going to say a year, it's been more than a year now, the pandemic, when it comes to distance learning, being a student, having the social side of being in your teens as well. What's helped, you know, you stay positive and focused?
The pandemic was definitely a struggle. It was weird for everyone. Like it was hard to understand how everything works. But to me, towards the middle of it, I realized that it was actually some sort of a blessing for me, actually. It gave me a lot of time to work on like the unwritten lines and Sahi, and that was all I was doing with my spare time, and the year flew by so quickly, actually.
We are, of course, coming into exam season. I still, even now, like 20 years after I was at school, start to get that kind of flutter around the kind of April, May time and go, oh, I feel like I should be having some revision timetable. Any tips for anyone who's got exams on the horizon? What did you find useful when it came to studying for your exams?
Time management. Definitely time management. You make a schedule and stick to that. Don't go a minute beyond or a minute or less, and everything should be fine. If you started early and you prepared yourself properly and not try to do everything in one night, it'll end up perfect for you.
So when are you going to go to Boston before I let you get back to your two businesses? When are you heading off to the States?
I think I'm going to go with my family towards the end of July just to settle there, see the city. And I'm supposed to start in the fall, September.
My brother studied in Boston. I would just say one thing. It's a beautiful city, but please buy a raincoat. It absolutely tipped it down the whole time we were there. You're going to absolutely love it. Yusuf Gabriel, thank you so, so much. Huge congratulations. What an incredible achievement. Keep us posted. And what a credit to your family and the UAE you are. Thank you so, so much. Congrats.
Thank you.
And good luck. Yusuf there, age 18, heading off to Boston University with one of just 20 trustee scholarships out of 64,000 people who applied. Unbelievable. What a guy.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
If, like me, you are, well, somewhat reliant on the iPad when it comes to your parenting styles, you'll be pleased to hear that YouTube Kids is now live in the region, but curious to know what it offers and how it's different from the normal YouTube platform. This has been explained to us by Dahlia Alfaki, the Communications and Public Affairs Manager for the MENA region at Google. And I was pretty honest with her. I have to say, I do have a bit of a love-hate relationship with YouTube. And there are definitely some videos and indeed individuals I would rather never see again.
I can completely relate to your feelings, Helen. I think it's really, really important off the bat to highlight the fact that YouTube, what you refer to as YouTube Main, is not for children. It's not made for children under the age of 13. And that's why we launched YouTube Kids as a separate, standalone application and video streaming service aimed for children between the ages of 4 and 12. It really offers parents a range of different parental controls to help them customize the experience based on their children's needs and based on their interests and values as families as well. Mm-hmm. And that's what differentiates it mainly from YouTube, is the fact that it's tailored for families, it's tailored for kids, and it really has content that's appropriate for age groups under the age of 13.
Are you able to give us a little bit of what happens behind the scenes in terms of vetting that content? Are there certain flags or keywords or the way that that content's uploaded that would make sure that you know as a provider that it's going to be suitable for that platform and that age group?
Absolutely. So from our side, we've got a range of very rigorous policies that outline what kind of content is appropriate for YouTube Kids and what content is not appropriate for YouTube Kids. And these policies we've developed with experts and based on feedback from parents as well. Mm-hmm. And obviously, an element of the content that goes into YouTube Kids is dependent on algorithms, but there is also a human review element to it as well. And we do our utmost to make sure that all of the content there is appropriate for kids under the age of 13. However, just to note like a couple of things. So first of all, no family is the same. So there might be a video that I don't want my son watching, for example. But another family is completely fine with it. And I have full control in terms of blocking that video or that channel completely. And at the same time, no system is 100% perfect. And we really do our best to continuously update YouTube Kids, especially the content that's available there, based on feedback from families. And so we always encourage parents to flag any content they feel is not appropriate, because we really want to improve the product as much as possible to make it the best possible experience for families.
Here's my question. When you're talking about kind of customising content, depending on what your individual needs are, there's one child in particular, Roma and Deanna. I can't deal with them in any shape or form. Is there a way of blocking certain channels or individuals or even styles of programming? So, for instance, if you're like, I cannot bear my child to watch any more slime making, or, you know, Barbie is just doing my head in. How specific can you get? Can I get rid of Deanna in our household?
You can get rid of Deanna
in
your household.
Oh, my goodness, this is the best day of my life.
So there is an option for you to block complete channels. So you can just block the whole channel if you want. Or block specific videos, that's one option for you to do, and it won't show up for that specific child's profile. So if you decide you want to, for example, slime making videos for your child, you can do that. But if another child really wants to watch slime making videos and you're still okay with them watching slime making videos, mm-hmm. you can still keep that for them. That's one of the parental controls that we have. You can also switch off search on YouTube Kids, so that means that you can handpick specific channels and videos for them to watch, and they won't be able to look or search for additional videos beyond these videos that you've selected, because search will be off, obviously. There's another feature that I find particularly helpful. I'm the parent of a four-year-old who, when like he has very, very specific times when he can watch content, and it's always a battle trying to get him to stop watching something online. Mm. There's a built-in timer. So the timer becomes the bad cop, as you may, who will effectively tell my kids, okay, your time's up now, and it's based on the timing that I specify within the app. So I'll say, for example, half an hour, 20 minutes. And then he gets a notification that says, time's up, and that helps him to transition into another activity.
I love that. So you're kind of going, right, well, you know, the iPad's saying we're on a countdown now, and it's something tangible rather than going, you've just got a few more minutes. You know, it's a hard end. Okay, this is really helpful, because I think so many of us, whether it is them this morning, for example, waking me up at 5:35 and me going, yep, fine, just please don't watch Roma and Deanna. Or, you know, it being on a play date where you might want to be a bit more cautious about people, you know, what other families' kids are watching. Can I ask you about when it comes to kids as creators? And I don't want to single out my, you know, young Ukrainian friends, because I know there are some brilliant families and individuals who are creating content for kids, including some people here in Dubai, actually. What if our child has decided they want to be a YouTuber and they want to explore some creativity? How can they do that in a safe environment?
I think what's most important is that when it comes to child creators, it's really, really up to the parents. Because ultimately, when you upload a video to YouTube, we prompt creators with children in their videos that they need to understand their legal obligations. Mm-hmm. And then it takes them on to a help center article with information that they need to keep in mind to keep minors safe. And that's the most important thing. And it's ultimately the responsibility of the adult to adhere to all of these different child labor laws and regulations, for example, making sure they have permits, making sure that the participation in the videos doesn't impact their education, because their education is incredibly important. So ultimately, it really comes down to the adults, or the parents in this case specifically, to help ensure that they protect them as much as possible and they adhere with all these legalities. And we make sure that we prompt them as well so that they're aware of the fact that they need to ensure all of these regulations and requirements to keep them safe.
I wanted to ask you about the education side, because something we have been coming to an awful lot over the course of the last year is that distance learning. And my kids are using an app called Seesaw, and they would embed links into YouTube. What are some of your favourite providers or even themes for a bit of free education thanks to screen time?
My personal favourites, there are quite a few. I'm a big fan of Blippi. Again, I have a young kid. I really like Blippi. I think Blippi helps.
Do you watch it when your child's not around, Dahlia?
Well, I actually don't mind. I actually really don't mind. There's also Storybots is also something else that we enjoy. There's a range of educational content out there, especially, and it's all available on YouTube Kids, and that's the beauty, I think, of YouTube Kids. It gives you a lot of different educational content, but there's also entertainment content as well. And so it doesn't always have to be just a child watching the same content. They can actually learn something and develop their creativity and their imagination and explore things that they wanted to learn more about as well through the app, given the wide scope of content that it hosts.
Can I ask you, what happens with the platform internationally? Is there much difference between the different regions? Or if I am on YouTube Kids in Dubai and I go to, you know, I happen to be in the States, not happening anytime soon, and get onto YouTube Kids there, is there any difference in terms of what's on that platform?
So there's a mild difference, because obviously we take into consideration local requirements and customs and needs, and also local laws. So we need to be adhering to all local laws in terms of the content that's available on YouTube Kids. But in terms of functionality, it's more or less the same in terms of the parental controls that we offer. However, the content can differ, and also the language availability would differ as well, depending on where you are.
What's really surprised me recently is that some people don't know that YouTube Kids exists as a standalone product, if that makes sense. And I think why I really like it, to be honest, is it looks kid-friendly. It looks very different to what I think of as being the, you know, the adult kind of main site. It's got silly sound effects. It's got, you know, picture-based navigation. It's all quite whimsical and fun, and it's pretty easy to navigate. So I wanted to ask you then, if it is easy to navigate, how can we make sure that the settings and parental controls aren't going to be hacked by kids that might be more technologically advanced than their parents? And what kind of safeguarding measures are in place there, Dahlia?
I think that's a really, really good question. So there's a couple of elements. So first of all, for you to make any changes to the account, you need to log in as a parent. And to confirm that you're a parent, it asks you either for a math equation, which I have no shame in telling the world that I fail continuously as an adult, or you can also set your own password. So this is one element that makes sure that your kids are not able to make any amendments or changes to the settings that you've indicated or specified for each of your different children, because you have different profiles for different kids.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
It is Sunday. We talk about children's health, about parenting, about education. And YouTube is, well, it's definitely got its pros and its cons, but certainly a few more pros in that column when it comes to YouTube Kids. Making sure that your children are using that platform safely. In conversation now with Dahlia El-Fekki. She is the Communications and Public Affairs Manager for the MENA region at Google. She's been telling us how it works and giving us advice on how to make sure I'm making good use of the parental control features on the platform.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
There is this range of parental controls, and you can also go back and see what your children have watched before, if you'd like, just to get an idea of the content that they're interested in now. What kind of, are they still really keen on slime-making videos, for example? So it makes it easier for you to see what they're interested in as well, and then you can use all of the other features that I mentioned before, for example, like blocking videos, hamping content, to make sure that they can't undo these settings. And any attempt to change these settings will require them to put in either, if you decided to put in a password specifically, or the math equation, or for you to sign into your account completely as an adult.
Dahlia, one thing I wanted to ask you is about ads, because, you know, me growing up in the UK, we used to come home from school, watch a few hours of TV, and there'd be adverts for, you know, especially around holiday time for specific products. And one thing I really like about streaming is that my kids aren't kind of privy to loads of adverts, which means I'm not being bugged for lots of different toys, unless we go to, you know, a toy shop or they see something at a friend's house. What about ads on YouTube Kids? Is there any kind of ad blocker, and what kind of controls are there in terms of that content?
There are going to be ads on YouTube Kids, and the idea is because we want to be able to offer families quality content that they can enjoy for free. And to be able to do that, we need to be able to pay the creators who put so much effort into the beautiful work that they do. At the same time, all of our ads comply with strict policies that we have and human review guidelines. And so there will be limited paid ads on the app. But they have to be verified, A, as family friendly, and B, they're clearly labeled as ads, and they won't include any click through to websites or product purchases, which means effectively, even if a child sees an ad, they can't click on it and go somewhere else.
And spend your money.
And at the same, exactly. And at the same time, if parents want to have an ad-free experience, they can use their YouTube Premium subscription, and they won't have ads if they use their YouTube Premium subscription.
So that would translate, you would log into YouTube Kids with your premium account, and that would, have the same. Okay, that is really helpful, actually, because that is somewhere that I feel like my kids are kind of, well, it's also a bit of a time thing, but also it's not wanting to, the whinging. And last question, Dahlia. We've seen, unfortunately, always some kind of dark side to kids' programming, whether that is, Peppa Pig, Callaloo, or, videos being spliced with disturbing or inappropriate content. If anything is found, and there's always going to be a small chance that, no platform is 100% perfect, but if something is found that's not age appropriate, what is the reporting method? How does it work to make sure it is flagged to people that can remove it?
It's actually quite simple. So on the video itself, you just click on the three dots on top of each other and you click flag. And then it will ask you to specify what the issue is. The team looks into it, and we, if it violates our policies, if it's harmful, we remove it immediately. And we try to take very, very swift action. And that's why it's super important for us and for parents to make sure that if they see something that makes them concerned at any point in time, to please, please, please report the content so that we can ensure that YouTube Kids remains a family-friendly space.
Dahlia, thank you so much for your time today. You've honestly brightened my day that I might not need to see a certain child in my home ever again. Would you mind just reminding us of some of the new features that we need to know about to make sure kids are safe, kids are secure, and that we can control that content? When it comes to settings, is it as simple as it looks? Logging in and ticking a few boxes?
Absolutely. So when you first go in, it actually asks you, for example, if you want to have search on or search off. It asks you of the age range of your children so that you can see specific content based on the different age ranges, whether they're preschoolers or age 5 to 7 or an older age group. And you can also choose to handpick the content yourself. And that's all from the onset when you log in for the first time. And then once you're in the app as well, it's really easy for you to block and flag videos. You'll be able to see some collections by trusted partners and YouTube Kids as well. So these are videos that we have selected as YouTube Kids or some of our trusted partners who are experts when it comes to children and children's content that they put together as well. You can look at the videos that they've watched before by simply going back to your profile page and seeing the different kinds of videos that they have.
There you go, mums and dads, go forth, set up those controls and block those kids you hate. Loads of tips for navigating YouTube Kids and keeping our children away from content they should not be exposed to. Care of Dahlia Al-Faqi from Google in the MENA region.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Calling all mums. Speaking personally, it can be an incredibly lonely time. You think you're going to meet the friends of your life, but instead you're often feeding in the middle of the night. You don't quite have the time to do all the social engagements that you'd hoped for with your newborn. And sometimes it just doesn't come together. So where else can you turn to meet other mum friends? Of course, technology has come to the rescue. Mamma Me launched just 1 year ago. During the pandemic, we're joined now by the founder, Samaya Sawa. Samaya, before we start talking about the app for meeting other mums, I'd love to hear a bit about your story. Is it true that you gave birth to your baby in the back of an Uber?
You're right. I did. I gave birth to my daughter in the back of an Uber.
Oh my goodness. How many years ago was this? And please tell me you've got some kind of, discount for life.
I wish that was the case. She was born in the summer of 2018. I mean, I'm happy to share the story with you if you want to hear more about it.
Yes, of course. It's like this stuff that you'd see in a movie. And I often say, I forgive nobody for tailgating unless you're giving birth in the back of that car. And that I would have given your Uber a pass on my tailgating ban, because you were giving birth in the back of the car. Was it your first baby?
Yes. So it was really early morning, so 8:30 London traffic. And so when I got into the car, I was really close to giving birth, but at the time I had no idea. And so it just so happened my husband delivered her in the back seat.
Wow. Well, did you give her any kind of car or taxi inspired name? Is she called Uber?
No, her name is Leia. So she, unfortunately, I mean, luckily we didn't use Uber as her name. But you'd be happy to hear that on her birth certificate, it actually says the name of the street that she was born on.
Oh, that's amazing. I always wonder what happens if you give birth in the air, if they just kind of say, you know, Emirates flight EK56, or if they say above a certain country. I'm always fascinated. So if anyone out there can tell us, if you gave birth mid-air, please let us know. So let's talk socialising, because as I alluded to there, you know, the way that social media puts forward about, you know, meeting your mum tribe and you have a baby and you've got this ready-made group of mates, that is a lovely idea. And for anyone that happens to, incredible. I have been lucky enough to meet some brilliant mum friends, more so with my second than with my first. And it can be an incredibly lonely, isolating time when you are scrolling in the middle of the night, you know, feeding, looking at everyone else's easy, sleep-filled, friend-filled days and feeling like, you know, you're on your own a bit. So what did you experience, and why did you feel like there was a gap for something that could help introduce mums?
So that was exactly the same for me too. I mean, I think nearly every mother experiences that isolation and loneliness. And it's like you just mentioned, it's that middle of the night when you're up and you've never done that before, right? Until you become a mother, you've never had sort of someone to tend to in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. And for me, I was in London at the time when I gave birth, and I really relied on advice and support from mums that I'd met on a UK app for mums. And so when I came to the UAE, I just realized there wasn't anything similar. And that's why I set about learning how to create it to help the women and the moms here, to really bring them the same opportunity that I had in the UK.
Now, you're not necessarily from a tech background. You're from a teeth background. Is that right?
Yes, I'm a dentist. I've been a dentist for just over 9 years in London. But yeah, I mean, I'm completely self-taught tech entrepreneur. I've literally got my nose buried in a book all the time. I've enrolled in millions of online courses, and I actually even taught myself how to write an algorithm. So I'm really proud of where I've come from last year.
So when it comes to putting together an app, what kind of pain points were you trying to address? Because, you know, I say we're used to dating online. I'm not, and I'm forever grateful that I'm not. I didn't need to meet my husband in a swiping situation, because my tolerance for poor grammar is just, it would make the whole situation impossible. But, you know, we order food through apps. You know, we're teaching our kids through apps, you know, certainly over the course of the last year. Why did you feel like this kind of app could be the solution?
So I'm sure your listeners tuned in right now will actually relate to this. Life is super busy, especially with kids, right? We have a never-ending list of things to do. For us, I mean, I'm sure you're the same. I always seem to be behind the wheel of a car. And so there could be a mom just a few streets away and you don't even know who she is. And she's probably got a child similar age to yours, and she's probably doing the same kind of activities. And so the whole point of Mama ME is that it takes that hard work away and it does the hard work for you. So just with a couple of clicks and swipes, you can meet that mom. So it's really allowing you to expand your social network, because you probably would never get to meet that mom otherwise.
Obviously, it relies on there being a certain number of people using the platform in the first place. So what was that challenge like in terms of getting the word out when you first launched a year ago?
When we launched in the height of the pandemic. So if you look back a year ago, we were literally immersed in lockdown at this time of year. And so the moms were really wanting that, they had the desire to connect with other moms. And so that really helped us bring a solution to the moms at the time when they really needed it. So the app actually allowed for them to create the virtual connections at the time when they really needed it. And now what I'm finding is that more and more people are being vaccinated, and so the mums are feeling more comfortable with face-to-face interactions, and so the friendships they made offline and online this time last year, they're actually taking those offline and meeting in person. So it's really supported that aspect of helping them come together. And I think a lot of it has just been word of mouth and them hearing that this is a possibility through being on the radio and just getting information out there to the mums.
So can I ask then, when it comes to signing up, what kind of information are people sharing to make sure that they're going to make some meaningful connection, whether that is for a 3 a.m. chat saying, are you awake, or meeting up for play dates when they feel ready? What do you need to put on your profile?
So firstly, I'd like to mention that we are completely safe. And so we have a very secure, robust verification system to make sure that all the women that are joining are actually women. But we do ask the moms to add in the children's ages, how many children they have, what gender they are, and also their personal interests as well, because it's not just about connecting moms with other moms that have children the same age, but also your interests. Because if you're into fitness, for example, you want to meet someone who's also into fitness. If you like reading, you want to meet someone else that might be into reading. So it just helps facilitate the fact that you want to meet moms that's beyond the fact that they're just moms.
How does it work in terms of matching and interacting?
So we match based on all of the things that I mentioned. So we match you based on your age of their children, how many children the mom has, your interests, where you're based, and also your nationality as well. So you get, as a user, you have the option to connect with that person, because you'll see the profile in front of you,
right,
and you get to decide whether you want to initially connect with that person.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's Helen Farmer with you now in conversation with Samaya Saar, the founder of Mama and Me app. She's developed an algorithm to connect like-minded mums. Yes, Tinder for mamas. It does have a rigorous registration process and even asks questions like, what season are you? So I asked her about that.
So it's really to facilitate that conversation, to be able to see past what, because a lot of people will have similar things in terms of interests, etc. But if you describe your season in a certain way, you describe your personality as a season, then that gives you an insight into what the person actually is like, rather than it just being a surface, this is what I like to do and this is what I like to do at the weekends. And it gives you a better insight. It's just a sort of conversation starter.
And can I ask, do you have any plans to take things offline yourself as an app, in terms of actual meetups and mingles and things, when obviously it is safe and allowed?
So we had a great response at our launch party at Tanya's Tea House, and I was really delighted to meet the app users in person. And we have definitely got plans to have more in-person events as things start to sort of settle. So we're hoping that will become more of a regular occurrence.
Something I have really felt for, and I mentioned the coffee mornings earlier, but the course of the last year, it just hasn't been possible, and I've had so many people reach out to me, through Instagram or through the radio show, or just mention in passing about friends that they've got who have been so isolated and have been so understandably worried about them staying safe, keeping their babies safe. They've, perhaps have babies who have never met anyone outside their immediate family. I love that there is something for that group of people who right now are not feeling comfortable or just want a way of, also, it's just super practical. The fact that it's an app helps, I would say, because, if you are breast or bottle feeding, you can have your phone in one hand. And I know you shouldn't do this. We should be paying attention to every mindful moment of our children's, precious existence. But being able to, have a little chat with one hand on an app is, I'm sure you thought about this rather than it just being a website from the beginning. So thank you for that. What are your hopes for the future? How many users do you have and how many are you aiming for?
So, it's been incredible. We have created our Dubai Mama community now. And so we have some really exciting growth plans to spread across the MENA region. The app is actually now seeking investment also. So we have some great plans for the future. We've got just over 5,000 users. So I'm really excited for where we're going in the next year.
And can I just ask, is there any kind of cost attached to joining? Would that be, you know, something people need to be mindful of? I'm just going to have a little join myself this afternoon. But are there any hidden costs, or what's the business model like?
So the app is completely free to download, and you can find it on the App Store, the Apple App Store, and the Google Play Store as well. And it's Mama ME, so it's MAMA. There's a space in between, and then it's ME for Middle East.
Brilliant. A wonderful idea. Are you still working as a dentist, or are you full-time tech whiz kid now?
I've given up dentistry.
Oh, well, huge congratulations. It's really wonderful to hear a positive business story, but also a positive story of the community coming out of the pandemic. I think many people panicked when they were launching this time last year, but it sounds like you're providing a really valuable solution to a very, very common problem. And the more mums that can get on the platform, find each other, and even if they never meet in real life, just have someone they can have a rant to, share the small wins with, and have as a mummy friend, either online or offline, is only going to be a good thing. So my thank you so much for your time today. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Helen.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Thanks again for downloading this episode of Afternoons with Helen Farmer. We, of course, are live on Dubai Eye 103.8 every single weekday, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Please do rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, and it means you'll get it straight to your phone. Speak to you soon.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.